Good evening. I don't have an ominous announcement. I'm just here to welcome you. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you to this month's edition of Headliners. For those of you who may be joining us tonight for the first time, Headliners is a new monthly forum providing opportunities to meet members of the university's faculty whose expertise illuminates stories in the headlines or whose research is making news and national headlines. This is just the third event in this new series, but already you can see the wide range of topics it will cover, from the war in the Middle East to the social networks on the internet to tonight's topic, the science of stem cell research. So we hope you'll join us every month for these fascinating and very diverse discussions. If you do have to miss one, though, we're recording Headliners and posting the audio on our website, where you can listen to or download or put on your iPod if you're really cool, each month's session. For this reason, I also want to ask you to please use one of the microphones during tonight's discussion portion to ensure that everyone can hear your questions both here as well as online. And if you don't mind, again, I want to ask you to keep your questions direct and to the point as much as possible so that we can get to just as many questions as possible tonight. Well, last month's midterm elections demonstrated that stem cell research is still used as a polarizing political issue. Voters across the country were bombarded with campaign ads featuring celebrities on both sides of this emotional debate. But very little was said about the actual science behind stem cell research, and many voters were left more confused than ever. How will the dramatic results of the midterm elections eventually affect stem cell research? What's the prospect for therapeutic solutions resulting from this research for diseases such as Parkinson's, diabetes, and heart disease? And when will these treatments become available in the future? Tonight, we're fortunate to have one of this country's leading stem cell scientists to help us understand these complicated issues. Dr. Mary Firpo is a leading embryonic stem cell scientist whose research focuses on finding a cure for diabetes. She came to the University of Minnesota's Stem Cell Institute in 2004, where she is working to create insulin-producing cells for transplant into patients with this disease. Prior to joining the U of M Medical School, Dr. Firpo was research professor in the Center for Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. There she directed the Human Embryonic Stem Cell Laboratory and was responsible for the derivation of two of the stem cell lines included in the National Institutes of Health Registry of Human Embryonic Stem Cells. As you can imagine, she is often asked why she left San Francisco to come to the University of Minnesota. But according to her, none of the people asking these questions are medical researchers. The U of M established the first stem cell institute in the world 16 years ago and has been at the forefront of diabetes treatment since 1966. Here, in addition to conducting her own research, Dr. Firpo leads an NIH-funded training program where other researchers come to the university from all over the world to learn how to grow and work with embryonic stem cells. What a pleasure to have you here tonight with us to learn from you. Will you please join me in welcoming Dr. Mary Firpo?
Well, thank you for that nice introduction. Thank you for having me here tonight. Thank you for all coming out to listen to me talk about my research. And I'll tell you a little bit about why I came here and why I do this research. And you'll start to understand a little bit about all the different types of stem cells and what we can use them for to learn about human biology and also in developing cures for many, many different diseases. And stem cell biology has been around for a long time. And I became interested in doing stem cell research because, not because I even knew what a stem cell was, because when I first started doing research back in the 80s, when I started graduate school in New York, we thought about stem cells as only being one type of cell. In fact, the only people who really talked about stem cells the way we talk about them today were people who were interested in doing bone marrow transplantation. And indeed, bone marrow transplant is the first stem cell therapy, and it's been done for almost 40 years in the world. Does anyone know where the first successful bone marrow transplant was done? at the University of Minnesota in 1968. So the University of Minnesota has been in the field of stem cell research and has been very on the forefront of stem cell research since the beginning of the field. And not knowing that, I did my graduate training in New York at the Sloan Kettering Institute, where it's a cancer hospital associated with Cornell Medical School, where they're interested in doing bone marrow transplantation as a cure mostly for leukemias. And what I learned in the process of my work at the Sloan Kettering Institute was that the stem cells of the bone marrow are the key instruments to a cure of various diseases. In fact, when you hear a list in the sort of political rhetoric about all of the diseases that can be cured by stem cells, adult stem cells, almost all of them, almost without exception, all of those cures are through bone marrow transplantation. So there's several different diseases that can be cured this way, but the bone marrow transplant is the most long studied and most successful stem cell therapy. And in the process of studying what cells in the bone marrow were responsible for curing the disease leukemia when you replace one hematopoietic system, one bone marrow, with another person's bone marrow to get rid of cancer cells or to cure a genetic deficiency, what you end up with is a more and more pure population of cells that you can study that have the properties of a stem cell. So let me just start out with a little bit about what is a stem cell. Oh, I'm missing that. Oh, here it is, this slide. So somewhere I have a pointer here. And maybe since there's two screens, I'll try pointing with my computer. So a stem cell has to have two properties. Two characteristics to be considered a stem cell. So it has to have the capacity to proliferate, and proliferate meaning expand, divide, and make more cells. And in the process of this proliferation, it has to be able to differentiate. Now, typically, particularly in adult stem cells, the stem cell is a very rare population of cells in the tissue, and it itself does not have a function. So it's the mature. Oh, my pointer arrives. So, but maybe I'll try to still point with my computer anyway, so that you can see on both sides. So the stem cells themselves don't have a function within the tissue. They're very rare cells, but they have this capacity when needed to proliferate and create during this process of differentiation to change from a stem cell to a functional cell, and that process was really first understood in a clinical setting with the bone marrow stem cells. So the stem cells that can self-renew and can proliferate and differentiate to all the different blood cells. So the second property a stem cell must have, and this is the property in research, and when you read the paper, people often forget to show. The stem cell must have the capacity to differentiate. It also must have the capacity to proliferate without differentiation. That means to expand and make more stem cells with the same potential as the original stem cell without actually expressing that potential through differentiation. So all of my animations are missing here. You know what? Okay, let me just start here again. This is the lecture I want to give today. That was a lecture I gave to some students about 2 weeks ago. Anyway, so here we are back here. The stem cell has to have a combination of two properties. So it has to be able to proliferate and to differentiate, and it has to be able to proliferate without differentiating, and that process we call self-renewal. So that's extremely important. So the stem cell has to be able to differentiate, and it has to be able to self-renew. And that decision, at every cell division, the cell has to decide, do I self-renew or do I differentiate? And often, a stem cell will divide and make two cells, one that remains a stem cell and one that differentiates. In that way, you can keep the same number of stem cells throughout your life. And this is what we think happens in the bone marrow often, that a single cell differentiates and a single cell self-renew, or there's one is self-renewal and one differentiation in the same division. But in the case of bone marrow transplant, we know that that is not the case, because you can give as few as one stem cell to a mouse without a bone marrow and repopulate the entire bone marrow with stem cells and even allow that recipient mouse to then become a donor for a second recipient. So the stem cell capacity to self-renew is quite large. And this property of self-renewal is what allows a durable engraftment. That is, when we give a transplant, to allow the cells to produce blood for throughout the life of the recipient. So just as an example of this, think about so you're at a picnic and you cut yourself on your sardine can, and you have lost a lot of blood. And you go to the doctor, and they say, okay, what do you need? Well, you get a blood transfusion, right? Why do you get a blood transfusion? Those are all mature cells, but your bone marrow is still intact, and your stem cells will divide and make more mature cells. You just need a transfusion to keep you alive until your bone marrow does the work. But say, for example, your picnic was at Chernobyl. And now you have a problem because your bone marrow is now dead. So what do you need? A transfusion? That will only keep you alive for a couple of days. What you really need is stem cells. In that case, you need a bone marrow transplant, and right away, preferably with a transfusion too. So you have this, you have a sort of a difference between whether you need something temporarily or whether you need a durable transplant. And that's the difference between a stem cell therapy and other cell-based therapies. And in many cases, if your stem cells are still intact, all you need to do is keep the tissue alive until the stem cells can regenerate it. So these stem cell therapies, remember, this property of self-renewal is absolutely crucial. So when you're reading papers in the literature, where someone says, oh, we took some blood and we gave it to him and he got better, you actually need to show that a single cell can do the job by itself to show that you have really a stem cell. So now you guys are experts beyond 90% of the scientists in the stem cell community. And I have been called the stem cell police before, so you can trust me with that. So if the cell can proliferate and differentiate, we call it a precursor, right? So it can differentiate into tissues. But if it can proliferate, differentiate, and self-renew, stem cell. Okay, so here's my example from the Chernobyl situation, that if you cut yourself, ooh, it's cold outside, that if... if you cut yourself, then you can get away with getting a transfusion of the mature cells. But if you really have lost all of your stem cells, then what you need is a bone marrow transplant that contains very, very good quality stem cells that can self-renew for a long time and that you can stay alive, because you need lots and lots of new blood cells every day. Billions and trillions of new cells. Your body makes blood cells. You know, when I was an undergrad, or even in high school, I learned this number in my really boring biology classes that said, your red blood cells live about 100 days. And I thought, dang, that's not very long. It's really only about 3 months. But in fact, your red blood cells are some of the longest-lived blood cells that you have. And some of your cells actually only last about a couple hours. So you're constantly regenerating your blood, and you need those stem cells to be functioning. So what about other cells? So not just bone marrow stem cells, right? There are lots of stem cells. Well, we didn't know that. In fact, we actually only knew of very few tissues that regenerated. And now, looking at stem cells really more broadly, rather than just in the bone marrow transplant community, we actually can tell that many cells, many tissues regenerate. For example, I mean, think about it. Your skin is constantly regenerating. Your hair. Now, if you could find a hair stem cell transplant... I'm just saying, if you're looking to make some money, that's where I'd go. So when I was talking about the hematopoietic organs, and when I say hematopoietic, I mean blood forming. I don't know why, but I like that word. It's kind of nice, sort of poetic. But lots of tissues regenerate. For example, the way you build new muscle is to actually injure your muscles, and the stem cells within your muscles proliferate and make new muscles. And when they make new muscles, they make it larger. So you actually have this regeneration process. It's something that goes on in your body all the time. You don't even think about it. And for example, the liver is an amazing organ. You can lose more than half of your liver and it will grow back. just like a lizard's tail. And it's really the only organ that can do that, but we'd like to be able to sort of tap into that huge regenerative property that comes along with stem cells in the organs and be able to do these kinds of transplants for many tissues, not just bone marrow. And I should say that I've learned this quite recently, that another stem cell transplant that's quite common, that's not very well known because it's not looked at so much in the press, strangely, they choose things somewhat randomly to talk about, that skin stem cells, that if you are very badly burned, there's a technique now for taking whatever skin cells are left on your body and culturing them out and giving you a graft of skin that was generated from your own skin stem cells. So there are actually some other stem cell therapies that are less well understood and less long-term studied than the bone marrow. But there are lots of other examples where we found now stem cells in the brain that can regenerate specific parts of your brain. And, for example, male germ cells, if you think about it, are constantly regenerating and making new mature sperm cells. So there are lots of examples in your everyday existence that you probably haven't thought about, but the stem cells are responsible for that process. Unfortunately for diabetes patients, the pancreas is the one organ that has been looked at carefully where no stem cell has been found in the adult. And people have looked pretty carefully, and there are some people who have concluded that there are no adult stem cells, that the insulin-producing cells, the beta cells as we call them, actually can proliferate to some extent themselves, but that all of the regeneration that happens of the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas come from pre-existing beta cells. So if you have type 1 diabetes and your beta cells are being killed by your immune system, then you are in trouble. So the question is that if there are adult stem cells in many, many tissues, why don't we rely on those for transplantation? And it comes down to this very, very simple fact, that even though we have been studying these cells in the bone marrow community for 40 years, we have not come up with a way to get these cells to self-renew outside of the body. So if you need a bone marrow transplant, you need a person to give you their bone marrow. There's no way that we can take bone marrow from one person and get the stem cells to self-renew to the extent that we know they can in vivo, right? We know they can in your body. When you get a bone marrow transplant, they do that very well. But we haven't found a way to do this outside of the body. And just as a way of confession, that was the basis of my thesis project, that I was supposed to find a way to get stem cells to self-renew in a dish in the lab, and that we would cure everybody who needed a bone marrow transplant. Because frankly, for many diseases, most people who need a bone marrow transplant can't have one because there aren't enough donors for them. So because of that, I actually started to think about other sources of stem cells. So if we can't find bone marrow stem cells and expand them in the dish, maybe we can generate them from another source. That'd be great. So how do we do that? So I thought, well, we could go to the pre-adult and see if we can't do this the same way that it happens in the embryo and the fetus. And if we could find a source of stem cells that we could generate any type of cell from and that would self-renew in a dish, then we'd be on to something. And even though this is asking for a lot more than we were asking from our bone marrow stem cells, the fact is that this stem cell does exist. So now, just this is a review. This Catherine Verfey came up with this, and I stole it from her. So here's a stem cell. It's a pluripotent stem cell. That means that it can become many different types of tissues. So its potential is multiple tissues. So this stem cell can self-renew and make more of them. And then when we ask it to, boom, we can ask it to make many different tissues and use those different tissues for transplantation. And so where do we find these magical cells? There's actually two places to find them. So I'm just going to give you sort of a cycle of developmental biology in 1 minute. This is a course in mammalian developmental biology. So there's an egg and a sperm, and those two cells fuse. And at that point, you have a totipotent stem cell. That is, the zygote is the single cell that all of our whole body is derived from. So that process of self-renewal and differentiation, that combination, results in a pretty complicated organism that contains many, many different tissues. And that cell goes through a process of differentiation, implants in the uterus, and then somehow a magical pluripotent stem cell comes from that. But in fact, that there are two sources of pluripotent stem cells. One comes from the body tissue and one comes from the germ cells. Those are the cells that give rise to the sperm and egg. And that gives us a cycle back again. So the stem cells, the stem cells that come from germ cells become eggs and sperm and then make this cycle again. Right, so you can think about the germ cells as though they were a sort of a special kind of stem cell. And then we have cells that give rise to all of the tissues of the body. And in the embryo, this is pretty easy to see when this division actually happens. Or we know something about it and we know where the cells go. So if we were to take one of these germ stem cells and get them to self-renew in the dish, or if we were able to take a pluripotent cell from the embryo and get it to self-renew in the dish, and either way we could get them to differentiate into all the tissues we wanted, either way would be quite acceptable. And in fact, this is what happened in 1998. Two people working, and not so independently as you might think. They were actually collaborating. John Gerhardt at Johns Hopkins University and Jamie Thompson at the University of Wisconsin each found ways of isolating these stem cells. So John Gerhardt from the germline and Jamie Thompson from the blastocyst stage embryo. And these are the cells we call embryonic stem cells, the ones that come from the embryo. These we call embryonic germ cells or EG cells that come from the germline. And these cells turn out to not be so good at self-renewing as these cells. So ta-da, now you know the whole story. So about this time, I was actually working on this project already at the time. And I should tell you that how I jumped from bone marrow transplant and adult stem cells to embryonic stem cells. I actually went to a lab that was studying mouse embryonic stem cells. And my job in that lab was to generate hematopoietic or bone marrow stem cells from the embryonic stem cells and show that they could do anything that the bone marrow could do. Fortunately, that one worked. So then I went on to start going back, because at the time it was not legal in this country to do research on human fetuses or human embryos in the sense that we can now. In fact, it was President Clinton was the first law, the first administrative rule he signed was to repeal the rules against working with human embryo and fetal tissue, and it hasn't been reversed yet. So we were looking at this type of work, and it works pretty well in the mouse, and it's actually been studied now for about 15 years or so, this type of in vitro differentiation. So you expand the cells, you get them to self-renew, and then you encourage them to differentiate into the different tissues and transplant them. So we get to the point of actually how do we make these. And at the time, I was working on grafting and transplanting hematopoietic stem cells in different ways that we could start to do gene therapy with them. I heard that the University of California was interested in developing an embryonic stem cell program, and so I went there and volunteered to be on their faculty. I'm sure that practically never works. But I somehow convinced them. So they hired me, and I started to work. And I was actually not interested in deriving human embryonic stem cells. I was interested in differentiating them once they were derived and making cells that we could use for transplantation, and particularly for diseases that were already manifested by the time you're born, like thalassemias, where by the time you're born, the damage is so great that there is no real way to save you, that we could actually do bone marrow transplants before you're born. So this was something I was quite interested in doing at the time. And so I was interested in working in the Reproductive Biology Center in OBGYN at UCSF. And plus, that's where they had the embryonic stem cell program, so it was excellent for me. And what happened, well, there's a long story about it, but what happened was we ended up doing it ourselves because no one else did it. So we took the embryos that were generated in the lab. And I should tell you one more thing. There are two places that we got these embryos for this research, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. The majority of the embryos that we do research with, at least at this time, were embryos that were created during reproductive therapy, so assisted reproduction or in vitro fertilization is often called, where the embryos were so poor quality that they were not able to make a pregnancy, and they're discarded routinely. And they're never frozen or kept or anything. They're just discarded because they're not useful to the patient. And it was those embryos that we were working with at the time. And there were lots and lots of them, thousands every day, thrown away every day. And it happens in every clinic everywhere. And it amounts to thousands a day that are thrown away. And we were working with these cells, these embryos, because we felt that since they were thrown away anyway and they wouldn't lead to a pregnancy, that we could actually do some research with them without really large ethical considerations, although we did go through a lot of ethical questions before we were able to do the work. So the university system is very careful about reviewing any human studies. So we got these embryos and we cultured them to this point. This is the blastocyst stage. And at this stage, differentiation has occurred, right? Because you can see there are two different cell types there, right? There's this outer ball of cells, the trophectoderm, and the inner ball of cells called the inner cell mass. And these cells in the trophectoderm are destined to only become the placenta. So they're the cells that actually allow implantation into the uterus and form the placenta. And these inner cell mass cells give rise to the whole embryo and the extraembryonic membranes like the amnion. So we took these cells from the inner cell mass and we cultured them on inactivated mouse fibroblasts. This is a source of cells that we knew could support self-renewal of mouse embryonic stem cells. So this was done initially by Jamie Thompson using exactly the same methods that are used for mouse embryonic stem cells. So these cells are then propagated and allowed to grow. And then we demonstrate that they have self-renewed by checking that the cells after culture have the same potential to differentiate as the cells before culture. Pretty simple. So this is what it actually looks like. And this is a blastocyst stage human embryo. And you can see that this embryo actually has the sort of outer lining of cells and then the inner cell mass. So people almost always ask me how big this is, and I always try to find a way of explaining it. But I could say, I'll tell you that this embryo and many of its friends could fit happily on a human hair. So these are very, very small cells at this point. They're about maybe between 30 and 100 cells in this blastocyst stage embryo. So we take the inner cell mass, we allow it to adhere to these feeder cells, we call them the inactivated mouse fibroblasts, and you can see some have stuck down, and then this ball of cells is still adhering, and they stick down on the plate. So now you guys are about to be experts in human embryonic stem cell biology. This is a typical morphology of an embryonic stem cell colony, and this is how we initially tell if the cells are self-renewing. The cells are very homogeneous. They're very small. They have practically no cytoplasm. It's all nucleus, which is indicative of cells that don't do much except divide, right? They don't really have that function yet. They're just dividing and growing. And the colony is very tightly packed, and you can see a very tight edge of the colony. They appear to be growing, floating on top of the feeder cells. When you have differentiation, you lose that tight edge and the cells are not so tightly packed. You can see space between them and the cells then begin this differentiation process. It's pretty easy to see, right? The difference between the tightly packed cells and the cells that are moving away from each other. And in this case, this embryo did not give us self-renewal and the cells all senesced and died, as any cell that you cultured from anybody would do if you cultured it long enough. So we go through a whole list of criteria of whether or not it's ES cells, but remember, we look at the morphology, we make sure it has a normal karyotype, it has a normal number of chromosomes, but ultimately, it has to be able to differentiate into all the cell types, it has to be pluripotent, and it has to be able to divide and maintain that pluripotency so that we know, one, it's a pluripotent stem cell, and two, that it's a stem cell at all. So we have to monitor self-renewal, and we have to monitor pluripotency. So once we do that, then we can actually do lots of things. And this is where these cells are quite unique. Because they're pluripotent, and because they self-renew in vitro, we can use them as a model of normal human development. We watch this developmental process occur, and we can actually watch the differentiation of abnormal, genetically abnormal cells, and watch the disease process occur. And we could actually, even without transplanting these cells, come up with novel ways of treating diseases just by having this model system of the human developmental body, the human developmental process in our dish. So this is one utility of the cells, and this is what I'm quite interested in doing. We can also develop cells for cell therapy or for stem cell transplantation therapy. And a lot of attention is given to hematopoietic transplantation. So why would we do this, right? We have bone marrow transplantation. The reason is because we don't have enough donors for everyone who needs a transplant. So there's really a reason to have even therapies for diseases we already have a stem cell therapy for. Neuro cells would be quite useful. There's also some cell-based therapies for Parkinson's disease. If we could develop these cells in a dish, we could give more of these cells without using fetal tissues. Heart muscle, heart disease, you know, is quite prevalent. And if we could repair the heart after a heart attack, then this would save many, many lives. And then the cells that my lab is interested in, the pancreatic islet cells that make insulin. Okay, so how do we do this? So we are assuming, we are showing, demonstrating that the process of differentiation from the embryonic stem cell to the gut, to specifying to the pancreas, and then to an insulin-producing cell, reproduces what we have in the embryo, in the fetus, and in the adult. It's pretty much as simple as that. It's a parallel process that we can not only watch happen, but actually intervene and see if we change this gene, what will happen to the cells. But unfortunately, unlike the bone marrow transplant field, diabetes research has never actually tried to isolate stem cells and transplant them. Why? Well, because they could never find a stem cell, right? So how do we actually study this? How do we actually find those cells that we want to transplant? Well, so this going back to history, at the time that we started working with embryonic stem cells, very soon after that, the president made a rule, the new president, President Bush, was elected, and he said there may only be federal funding for research using embryonic stem cell lines that are already derived as of now, August 9th, 2001, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time. Exactly at this moment. If the embryo was destroyed before this point, you may get federal funding. If it was destroyed after this point, no funding for you. Although no restrictions on any of the research. So at this point, I was sort of recruited, because we had two of the cell lines that were on this registry, recruited by the president to, one, distribute these special cells to people throughout the world who wanted to do the research, since he's made restrictions on which cell lines can be used. My cells became quite special. And two, because we had to teach people how to grow these cells. They're quite difficult to grow. And remember, we want self-renewal until we decide, and then we want differentiation. So these processes are quite finicky, and we were sort of asked to teach and help other people to do this work, which we did do, and we continue to do in my lab here in Minnesota. At the same time, the diabetes research community took sort of a strong political stand, saying that this is not ethical. If we really want to transplant these cell lines, we have to make these cells in a much more careful way so that we don't risk causing disease to the people who are getting the transplant. So we have to support people who know how to do these derivations to be able to make very carefully made stem cell lines for transplantation purposes. And they actually came to me and said, we would like you to do this. And I said, don't really want to be a cell factory. I really want to make differentiation happen and cure diseases. And they said, great, great, great. We'd actually like you to do that with diabetes using the tools that you use for bone marrow transplantation. And I thought about it, and I thought, this is pretty challenging. And, you know, I could still do bone marrow transplantation, but let's just take a look at this. And I went to the diabetes community, and the diabetes center at UCSF were incredibly helpful and adopted me and taught me what they knew about the biology of beta cell development. And it turned out that these people really do genetics. So all what they had was a list of genes that they know it has to be expressed, this gene first, then this gene, then this gene, then this gene. But there was no way of identifying the cells that were expressing those genes without hurting them. So how do we isolate these cells and try transplanting them to cure diabetes? We just don't have a way. And in the bone marrow transplant community, we use antibodies to select those cells out and transplant those cells that are the stem, that represent the stem cells. So we don't have these tools. And we also don't have assays to be able to say, is this becoming an insulin-producing cell or not? There just aren't these tools in the diabetes world. So the bone marrow transplant people ended up sort of
moving into the diabetes research field and being embraced, actually, by this community. So we came up with a plan. This is a plan that Mike German at the UCSF Diabetes Center and I worked on when I was still there in San Francisco. So we said, we'll just trick the cells into thinking they're expressing insulin, and they are expressing insulin from their own genes, and we will put genes from jellyfish that cause the cells to change colors, so that when the cell is making insulin, it's also making this fluorescent jellyfish gene that we call green fluorescent protein. So that we call reporter constructs. So whenever the cell is expressing insulin, it starts to glow green. Now we can find it. So we actually did a sort of series, a study, where we wanted to make the cells so that we aren't sure that the insulin-producing cells are the right cells to transplant. We want to transplant an earlier cell that will give a durable engraftment. So we said, okay, well, if we take this gene that's expressed before insulin and make the cells turn yellow, and then they turn green when they're making insulin, then we can just put them in a dish and watch them differentiate and watch the cells go from not colored to yellow to green plus yellow, because they turn this gene on again. And this turned out to work pretty well. So we can actually monitor the expression of all of these genes in a row, and we can look at four different colors at a time with these special machines that we have that can distinguish between that this one, when the cells turn red, it turns on, this one, when the cells turn yellow, and this one, they turn blue, and this one, they turn green. So we can watch the cells through this whole process. And I was extremely disappointed when I looked in the microscope. The red cells are really red. All the other ones are green. You can't really tell the difference between yellow, green, and blue. But we have a machine that can tell the difference. So we can actually sort these cells out and begin to study what they can do in a transplantation setting. And so this is where we are now. And this is how we can use this process of differentiation to actually generate the cells to study how we can make more to do transplantation. But we can also watch this process happen and understand better how the disease occurs, possibly preventing it. And we can also understand a little bit about normal biology that we wouldn't have been able to do before, because we can't just make people who turn yellow and green and blue. Okay, that I don't think would be ethical. So the other question that people always ask me, although I don't know, it would be kind of interesting to see him walking down the street. And you're awfully yellow today. Did you eat a lot of sugar? So you could watch your kids. So no, it wouldn't be right, but it would be kind of interesting to think about. So anyway, people often ask me, so where are we in this process? Because it seems like we're almost there, just listening to me talk, right? But so that we've actually started here. These are the things that we're going to need to do before we have a therapy for diabetes coming from embryonic stem cells. So first we have to be able to differentiate to the cells that we're interested in and show that they function. And we've made some progress here. But then we have to be able to isolate them from the other cells in our little fluorescent plan that should take care of that. Then we need to show that they actually will stay in the body and function once they're in the body. So functional long-term engraftment. And this will probably have to be done in large animal models, a small first and then large animal models. And then we have to demonstrate that they're safe, that they don't cause other problems that we didn't know might happen, that we couldn't detect in the lab. So these are the milestones that we need. And then I also wanted to just point out that there are some diseases that are going to be more amenable to this type of therapy than others. And the first ones that are going to be easy to do are the ones where we already have a stem cell therapy. So we can actually develop those cells in vitro and then find the ones that look just like the bone marrow ones and try those. So those types of therapies are going to be the first types of things that are tried. So, hematopoiesis, so bone marrow transplant, I'm looking at this. So these types of diseases that are curable by bone marrow transplant, or also delivering genes to somebody with ES-derived cells. And then diseases like diabetes, Parkinson's disease, or people with liver damage or muscular dystrophy, where there aren't developed stem cell programs yet, but that we would know kind of how to do it. There's a strategy because we know that there's a cell that's defective that we can replace. And then finally, there are other
diseases for which we don't know if replacing the cells will actually cure the disease, but we may later on be able to develop therapies, including Alzheimer's disease, Huntington's disease, and spinal cord injury. So these are the sort of process. So we have to, for each one of these, go through this process of developing the cell, making sure we can isolate it from other cells that may interfere with its function, and then engrafting it. So, and I'll just start, end with this, because I know you're probably thinking about this. So we want to know some, we want to consider very carefully the ethical issues when we're doing this. And I want to tell you that the patients that donate these embryos, both the embryos that are poor quality and now that we have access to frozen good quality embryos from those patients who finished their families, these embryos are very important to them. They really sacrifice a lot in these infertile couples. And they donate them to us with strong opinions about what should be done with them. So we take this very seriously. But I think we can take a step back from that and understand that there are questions that we should ask about, is it okay to destroy embryos? And if we decide that it's okay to, is it okay to generate embryos for the purpose of research or the purpose of therapies? Can we use embryos that are in excess, that are already destined for destruction, or can we actually generate new embryos just for the purpose of research? And this is actually not something that's quite as acceptable yet, but people are asking this question. We want to know also if the number of cell lines approved by the United States government are actually sufficient for the research or even therapies that we need to do. And frankly, I think that the majority of the scientists would say no for various reasons, and we can go into that if you're interested. And then if we don't use these for stem cell research, what do we do with the embryos that are discarded from in vitro fertilization? And as I told you, many, many, many embryos are discarded. And then also something I hope I've discussed already is why do we not use adult stem cells instead of embryonic stem cells for all of our research and therapy purposes? And then just a tiny bit on the policies and the legislation that's influencing embryonic stem cell research. So I went into the whole August 9th, 2001, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time rule that is held since then. The lines derived after that point must be studied without federal funding, and we do have those lines at the University of Minnesota. I should say that with funding from the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation and the Hillbloom Foundation that funds diabetes research, we derived 11 new lines under much more careful conditions that might be more amenable to therapeutic purposes. And those I brought with me to Minnesota and used in the lab. We have separated the funding for the two labs so that we can keep the research separate. The University of Minnesota does not allow state funding to be accepted for any research that is not federally fundable. This is a university policy. There are, though, various legislation bills that have been that are pending in Congress that may make the rules less or more restrictive. And in fact, one bill, H.R. 810, went to Congress and was passed by both houses of Congress in this past summer. That was vetoed by the president. It was his first veto ever. Then that bill would have made embryonic stem cell research fundable by the NIH for any cell lines, no matter when they were derived. But this was actually vetoed. And I expect that we'll see this legislation again in the near future. Okay. Well, I'll just stop there and maybe we can go to questions.
Just thinking that there's quite a few of us that would love to go to your lab tomorrow and hang out with you all day long. Is that right? Back here, let's see.
We have some red cells today.
Yeah, fantastic. Here comes the mic. Over back in the corner here.
If you derive a stem cell line, and you then transplant this particular line into someone with diabetes, will that line be rejected? Would you have to derive a line for everybody that you want to transplant?
So I was hoping someone was going to ask me that question. So the answer is yes. You have the same rejection issues as if you were getting any kind of transplant. And this is one of the arguments for making many, many, many cell lines so that we can try and get a tissue match for everyone. We don't really know right now with the technology we have. We don't really know any other way of doing that. But so you would have to either, and I actually forgot to say something else, so now I'm going to use your question to answer another question. That if for diabetes, there actually are transplant therapies. You can have a whole pancreas transplant, which works, or you can actually have an islet transplant, which is a short-term therapy. It lasts for a year or a couple of years. And in that case, again, you have to have immunosuppression throughout the time that you are hosting the grafts, or you will reject. So this doesn't really get around that problem at all.
Question right up front here.
So would that be a reason then to make stem cell, you know, grow embryos just specifically for the purpose of research, because just like bone marrow transplant, you have to, only certain people can be donors for certain people, so you'd want to have a variety. You could actually recruit people that had rare blood types or something to do the embryo thing, and I mean, would that be the reason that you'd want to do that?
You should come to my lab tomorrow and start looking like that. No, that's a very good question. It's actually not something that I have really sort of pushed for, but there actually are people. This is one strategy for doing it, because there are some people who have not so much like a universal donor, like blood donors, but they have a tissue type that's very, all of the genes are pretty much the same, and they can give donate to many different people. So this is one argument. I think that the way it's sort of being handled now is that rather than doing that, let's see what will happen with the excess embryos first and see how necessary that will be doing. And just to make this even more controversial, the same argument is being made for nuclear transfer, and that is making custom-made embryonic stem cell lines specifically for the purpose of matching, you know, a whole population of people, so that you could actually find, instead of making embryos from those people, to actually just take the nucleus from those people and create a new embryo and create a new cell line that way. So this is the argument for our nuclear transfer research as well. So those are the types of things that are being discussed, but not actually being put forward yet.
What's the status of stem cell research in other countries?
Well, there's a lot of very good research going on in other countries. And I, you know, being just an American myself, I'm surprised to see which countries are putting a lot of money into this. So Singapore is putting huge amounts of money in trying to recruit scientists from the United States. I think that there's issues that are make the research better or worse. So England, Australia, huge, good research going on in Australia. They're very advanced in reproductive biology in Australia and in vitro fertilization. So England, Australia, and Singapore, the United States, but many countries, in fact, most countries have an embryonic stem cell program. There's an organization called the International Stem Cell Initiative that's sort of a group of people who have made embryonic stem, who derived embryonic stem cell lines to get together and to try and come up with common procedures and common tests so that we can get a more standardized science, so that we can compare each other's data. And I am amazed. Iran has derived embryonic stem cells. So obviously Korea has tried. So it looks like maybe they have made embryonic stem cell lines, but some of the work they've done has actually not turned out to be true. But Italy, there are some countries where it's absolutely illegal. Germany, not allowed. And no embryonic stem cell research allowed. And other countries where it's allowed, but there's so much regulation that it makes it really hard to move forward. So in the United States, we're in a very strange situation. People think that there's a lot of regulation about doing embryonic stem cell research, and that's not true. There's regulation about funding, which means that it's very difficult to move the field forward and cure the diseases as quickly as we'd like to, but it doesn't mean that there's any restrictions on what you can do. In fact, there's very little regulation. And this is why I think that this work should be done in a university setting where there actually is a lot of ethical oversight into what we do and a lot of discussion and absolute transparency about what we're doing, so that people can see what we're doing, we can talk about what were the processes we used to make these decisions, and that the kind of work will be done will be that what people really need, rather than just cloning people or something like that.
I actually have two questions, if that's okay. First one, could stem cells be derived from fetal cord blood or placental tissue?
So is that the two questions? Okay. So that's very interesting because I get a lot of women calling me and ask me if I would like to have their cord blood because the cord blood banks tell them that the cord blood stem cells are the same as embryonic stem cells. And it's so generous of them. I just think that's so incredibly generous that it kills me that I have to tell them, no, that's not true. A cord blood stem cell is similar to the bone marrow stem cell. And the only therapies that are currently available for cord blood stem cells are really bone marrow transplant. And one single cord blood only has enough stem cells to really give a child of about 10. But now at the University of Minnesota, actually, John Wagner is doing studies where he combines cord bloods and gives adults bone marrow transplant with cord bloods. But placental cells are similar, although very, very early on. So it hasn't really been demonstrated, and they haven't been used in the clinic at all.
My second question, just like, you know, right now we can donate before we die, if we want to donate our kidney or our eyes, can we donate our bone marrow?
You can actually donate. There's a registry, a national registry. In fact, it's international registry now, so you can sign up. And in fact, depending on your ethnicity, there's lots and lots of some ethnic groups and not so many in others. So, particularly if you're African American or Asian, there's a real lack, a real need for bone marrow donors. So yes, the answer is yes.
What are the limitations for the existing pre-2001 embryonic stem cell lines that you alluded to?
You mean scientifically or
yes.
Regulation?
No.
Well, you know, having derived some of those and some afterwards, I don't really think that there's any real difference in their differentiation potential. They're, you know, when we were deriving those lines, we were just trying to see if we could get it to work. You know, we weren't trying to keep track of every batch of serum or every lot of medium that we used. We were just trying to see if it could work. We kept track of the science. In going forward, the difference between these cells and the other cells is that when we were thinking about doing this more from a clinical perspective, we didn't expose them to bovine serum. We didn't expose them to mouse cells. And now people are trying to derive the embryonic stem cells without feeders at all. And those are the kinds of careful studies that are going to need to be done before we can really be convinced they're safe. On the other hand, these pre-2001 lines may actually be clinically useful, and we haven't excluded that yet. So there, you know, there's maybe an important difference, but probably not at the level of self-renewal or differentiation potential.
Question in the center of the room here.
No, I have a question about differentiation. Years ago when I took embryology, people could watch differentiation under the microscope, but didn't really understand it. Can you control it? Do you understand differentiation?
No, and I actually didn't go into that too much, the way we do this. We actually, the way we get them to differentiate is to just take them off the feeders. And as soon as they're not in an environment that's supporting self-renewal, they actually continue to proliferate and they differentiate. And they form what we call an embryoid body that contains a lot of different cells. In fact, any cell we've looked for is contained in the embryoid body. But the difference between what's happening in our dish and what's happening in the embryo is the embryo, that's happening in a very organized way, right? You have right, left, you have head, tail, you have front, back. And the embryoid body is completely, almost completely randomly mixed. So we don't have a lot of the clues that you would look for, the sort of organogenesis kind of things. Here's a heart, right? It's beating. We'll have an embryoid body that starts to pulsate in the lab, but we don't actually have functional organs forming in it. So we watch it more by gene expression and by isolating the cells than actually watching this process begin. And I think it's probably better that way, that we're not creating actual embryos in the dish.
Question over here.
Was me next? Okay. I have two questions, actually. The first is there a lot of international sharing of information about stem cell research? Like, do countries share their information? Or
yes.
Okay. Pretty straightforward answer.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, in this, there's a lot of different sort of things in the world, and there's when you have a company, and you know, often the company will try and keep things secret. But in the scientific community, your work is not considered actually true until you share it and have your peers criticize it. So that's good. And the second thing is through this International Stem Cell Initiative, anyone who's derived an embryonic stem cell is then invited to come to these meetings and share their data and encouraged to compare cell lines and share reagents. I think this is the only way that we're actually going to be able to move the field forward quickly, is to be able to everyone agree, these are the tests we need to do, this is how we can culture the cells, and here are some standard ways of working with them and testing them. And that is actually happening.
Okay. And the second question then, is there anything you see politically or ethically in the near future that would really cease stem cell research or embryonic stem cell research as it's happening now, or either stop it or cause a great increase in it?
There actually is still legislation on the books, and some of it has been passed in one house of Congress that would make embryonic stem cell research illegal in this country and punishable by 10 years in prison and $1 million fine. And it hasn't gone to, it's sort of stuck in committees right now, but could actually come up and be voted, yes.
Question in the back.
And actually in states, the same sort of legislation is happening in various states.
Yeah, I was wondering, you said there were not enough donors for the bone marrow transplants. I was wondering about the insurance companies and medical assistants and whether they're covering bone marrow transplants.
I think it is, yeah, I think it's covered. Insurance companies will cover therapies that are not investigative. And I think bone marrow transplant is one of the few stem cell therapies that actually is is fairly accepted procedure. I'm not a clinician. I don't treat patients, but I'm pretty sure that's true.
Mm-hmm. Hi, you're doing a wonderful talk. Thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
I was wondering, is there any animal embryonic stem cell research being done that would elicit knowledge transferable into the human model?
Yeah, you know, excellent question. So, you know, as I said before, I started out, when I got frustrated with the bone marrow transplant field, I went into doing mouse embryonic stem cell research when I was in Denver. And we were fairly successful. What was surprising to find out that some information is the same between human and mouse, and some not even close. So we have long, and scientists have long used the mouse as a model of all mammals. And in some cases, that's been very instructive. But in some cases, when we actually go to the human, it turns out to not be true. So we'll use the mouse as sort of a starting point. And in fact, I mean, to be honest about it, a lot of the work we're doing now with human embryonic stem cells is repeating work that was done in the mouse. But it's amazing to me that the most fundamental thing about regulation of self-renewal in mouse embryonic stem cells, completely irrelevant to human embryonic stem cells. And so we're all looking for that LIF equivalent. So we're all looking for what the process is in human. And considering that we derived them using methods that were made for mouse embryonic stem cell studies, it's pretty amazing that it worked. Also, the other interesting thing is there's only a couple of strains of mouse that you can make embryonic stem cells from. And if you think about people being pretty much as different as any two people, as different as any two strains of mouse, that it works well with a lot of embryos that we don't control the strains of. So we think that we're pretty lucky that this worked. And pretty much no other animal has there been really good embryonic stem cells been made. Non-human primates as well. But yeah, it's amazing considering that. People have been working a long time on agricultural models to try and come up with embryonic stem cells, and this has not been as robust as mouse and human for some reason.
You know, when I hear talks like this, I know I should feel differently about mice, but where are you over in this side of the room?
Thank you for explaining this so well, but I'm a little bit dense, and I'm wondering if you could just review briefly again what the limitations are for using adult stem cells that require using embryonic stem cells.
Okay. So there's a couple of different layers of reason why. One is that we don't know of good ways of getting expansion or self-renewal of adult stem cells in the lab, which is something we're going to need to be able to do to give large-scale transplants to everyone who needs them. And in some cases, like in the case of diabetes, we don't actually know of an adult stem cell that we could use. So there's a couple of different ways this is. And in some cases, there are no animal models. For there's some diseases where there's no animal model, no mouse equivalent disease that we can study. So we can actually use the differentiation of these embryonic stem cells as a model for studying the disease without actually having to interfere with people.
Let's go to the back of the room here.
Right here?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you for your talks. Very enjoying. So two questions. One, just as a point of clarification on the legislature that you know about that's currently being discussed, is that for just what would happen if you use federal funds for that research?
No.
Okay, so that includes industry research.
You mean this, they make it illegal?
Yes.
Yes. Punishable by imprisonment.
Okay.
And in fact, the people who wrote the legislation wanted to make it illegal for Americans to go to other countries and get the therapies and come back. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to make it illegal for scientists from the United States to go to other countries to do the research and come back. That on return to the country, you would be arrested.
Okay. Second question on the adult stem cells. So with the exception of diabetes, where an adult stem cell hasn't been identified, where do you think the research is on when you have an adult stem cell population in a particular organ in vivo, if you can drive those cells for replacement? So I understand the distinction of they don't renew on the bench. Where is that research?
So the two therapies that I know of that are commonly used that are stem cell therapies are skin grafts and bone marrow transplant. And with few exceptions, there aren't very many well-studied stem cell therapies for any other organ. But there are stem cells that you can find. So, for example, in the brain, there are cells that we now recognize are stem cells, but they can't become every kind of brain cell. So there are some sort of limited things like that. I'm going to get really technical on you, but it's very interesting, actually, that the bone marrow stem cell is a stem cell that divides when you need it. So if you have an infection, you make more T cells and B cells. And if you have an injury, you make more red blood cells. So you have this responsive stem cell that responds to the environment and makes what's needed and in a very controlled way. In the liver, it's interesting that the stem cells are not involved until there's massive, massive injury. If there's a small amount of injury to the liver, the hepatocytes themselves divide. But if there's a large amount of injury, then it recruits the stem cells into activity. And this, I forget who it was who asked me this question, this may be what's happening in the pancreas, that there's just an extremely rare stem cell that we just haven't been able to find that may function under very extreme conditions. But those are all experimental. But there's a lot of research going on. And somebody asked me over here about cord blood. This is a very active field of research, even though I left it. To try and get cord blood stem cells or bone marrow stem cells to expand in the dish. And this could be incredibly useful. And if we could get that to work, then it would be absolutely wonderful. And I forgot to mention, this is terrible, that the director of the Stem Cell Institute at the University of Minnesota has found adult stem cells within the bone marrow that are not necessarily blood-forming cells, that she can get to self-renewal for limited periods of time. So using these kinds of techniques, we may actually be able to expand the field of adult stem cell research. But here's the thing. If we could find out why embryonic stem cells self-renew in the dish, we could try to make the adult stem cells self-renew. So we could actually revolutionize transplant biology, adult transplant biology, using embryonic stem cells. So when we talk about embryonic stem cell research, I think you guys are experts enough now to know that it's not just the transplanted cells that are important, but it's the model system that's important. The ability to self-renew, the ability to regulate differentiation into different tissues, that even just studying those things in the lab will allow us to expand adult stem cell research and the ability to transplant those cells. And if we never have to transplant an embryonic stem cell, derived cell, because we figured out how to get adult stem cells to self-renew with embryonic stem cells, I argue that that is enough reason to study these cells.
A comment and a question. A comment is, you referred to nuclear transfer, and I think most of us would think of that as therapeutic cloning. And the minute you say cloning, of course, everybody thinks we're going to grow another individual. So, but nuclear transfer is kind of the euphemism for that. The question I have, though, is we look
I
at this...
I used both terms.
Excuse me?
I did use both terms. But yes, you're right. You're right there.
This is really, in many ways, the very basement here, because how do you control the differentiation? And when you deliver that germ cell to the individual, how do you deliver it to the right place? And how do you know that you're going to be able to control it to turn into an islet cell and not a muscle cell or something else where it doesn't belong and wind up with some kind of a neoplasm?
Okay. So remember my list. I can go back there. So this is what we have to do. We have to differentiate the cells into the tissue we want. We have to isolate them from other things, and we have to get them to engraft and show that they're safe. You just listed all four of those things in your question.
But, so but that if you is get them to differentiate do. Already, they will no longer be a germ cell.
Pardon me?
If you've differentiated them, they won't be a germ cell, and they won't self-renew.
Okay, so we're not transferring germ cells. This is not something that is a goal of my lab anyway. In fact, I think that getting germline transfer, that would be actually that your progeny would then be from the embryonic stem cell, not from your own cells. But no, we aren't trying to transfer germ cells, so I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. What we're trying to transfer is differentiated progeny of the embryonic stem cells. So they were never really germ cells. Before they were an embryo, they were germ cells. But so we're trying to take these embryo cells, expand them in the dish, get them to self-renew, and then investigate ways to enhance the differentiation to a specific tissue, isolate those cells out from other cells, and get them to engraft in the right place and not cause tumors. So those are exactly the four list of things that we need to do that you mentioned. So there, you're hired too.
I'll be over in the morning.
Okay.
My question is, how long do you foresee it will take to start treating diabetes with stem cells?
I don't know. We have to do those. So we can get cells that, I'll confess all here, that we can get cells to make insulin. Not very many of the cells are making insulin, and not very many, and the cells that are making it aren't making enough. So there's where we are right now. So we have insulin-producing cells. We need to push them to be more mature. So this is where we are in that sense. The next thing we need to do is be able to isolate them. And I think our method will work, although we have not tested it in a large scale yet. And then we need to show that they can engraft and cure diabetes in a mouse. And then we'll need to do the same thing probably in a non-human primate to study safety. So all of those things are going to have to happen. And if we're able to move the first step forward quickly, the rest of the things will take several years, maybe 5 or 10 years to do. But we're not there yet, so it's hard to really predict. And when we actually have a clinical model, a clinical, you know, a set of cells that we can use, then we can start to do this. But I think that the other big question mark in there, and how long is this going to take, is the one thing that we have not been able to do is to scale this up in a kind of clinical model where we have to grow large quantities of cells. And this is going to require engineers. And they are just beginning to be interested in this field to the point where they can show us how to do these things on large scale. So the big question marks are going to be getting the cells that are functional in the dish so that we can go forward with the preclinical and clinical testing, which are somewhat more predictable in how long they take. And then also, before we can do this on a large scale clinical trials, we have to get the engineers to show us how to do it in large scale. So first we have to figure out how to do it in small scale, and then we go to the engineers and say, how do you make this happen with thousands and millions and trillions of cells. So it's going to take a while. I didn't say any years there. Sorry about that, but I can't really predict. Once they implant, either in the uterus or ectopically, then they're no longer, they're too far beyond that stage. So you can make embryonic germ cells, but not embryonic stem cells. Although, you know, I would not have guessed that you could take a single cell out of an earlier embryo and make an embryonic stem cell line out of it. It doesn't work very well, but that surprised the heck out of me. So maybe someone will figure out a way to do it, but not yet has anyone done that.
I had a clarification and a question. Clarification, is your research is done on type 1 diabetes, correct?
Well, in the sense that transplantation is normally done on type 1 diabetes, but it doesn't really restrict us to type 1 diabetes. But yes, the transplantation biology is normally done on type 1 diabetes where the patient's own beta cells have been killed. But there may be transplantation therapies that we could use for type 2 diabetes. The utility of my research for type 2 diabetes is going to be in the in vitro function studies where we can actually make the cells in the dish. We can change the conditions of them and actually find ways of intervening on type 2 diabetes without actually necessarily transplanting cells. But the transplantation part of the lab, the immediate application, yes, is type 1 diabetes.
Okay, and then my question was if you could possibly just give a brief overview of how stem cells are used in gene therapy.
Well, very interesting. There actually are stem cell gene therapies now, and this is, somebody asked me about tumors. This is where this has really come up. So gene therapy, for example, diseases where there's a gene missing, for like this boy in the bubble disease, severe combined immunodeficiency, there's an enzyme called adenosine deaminase that's actually missing, that if you can actually give the patient some cells that express adenosine deaminase, then you can actually, they can actually be normal and have a normal immune system. The problem is you need to get the DNA in there forever. And what's the cell that's most likely to do that? Right. So if you get into a stem cell, then the cell is going to be producing blood cells that are, and they do this with bone marrow stem cells since that's the one therapy that they really know how to do. So you can deliver the gene and it can actually be made in many different cell types as long as the enzyme is being produced and in the body. But getting the gene into the stem cell and getting durable expression is what they're looking for. The other way that you could do gene therapy would to actually be to replace someone's diseased tissue with new tissue that contains the proper disease. And in that sense, in a way, every time you give someone with thalassemia a bone marrow transplant to cure their disease, it's sort of a gene therapy using stem cells because you're giving them normal stem cells that contain normal genes to replace their other stem cells that had abnormal genes. So those are the kind of two meanings that I had with gene therapy.
Could you address using fetal cells for regeneration, especially in the brain?
For Parkinson's? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, this is very interesting. During the time that I've been a stem cell scientist, which is about 20 years now, that the term adult stem cell has grown to include everything except for embryonic stem cells. So we used to have this distinction of embryonic, fetal, and adult. And cord blood fell in between, right, because it's sort of fetal, sort of adult. Now pretty much anything that's fetal or later is considered an adult stem cell. But, you know, I'm not sure if anyone's ever demonstrated that those fetal cells that they transplant in to produce tyrosine hydroxylase, I think is what they're making, that those are dopamine. Tyrosine hydroxylase positive cells making dopamine, that those cells are not, I don't think anyone ever has shown that they're actually stem cells, that they would last for a really long time. But this is another course that we could do. In fact, you know, fetal tissue is a source of stem cells that could be tapped for transplantation as well. And cord blood works, so this is fetal tissue that's discarded at birth. But you could also technically do a bone marrow transplant using fetal liver, which is where blood is made in the fetus. And there are lots of sources of stem cells that could be used from fetal tissue. I think that the substantia nigra cells for Parkinson's is the only therapy I can think of right now. But I don't think you could really call it stem cell research because you haven't really shown that those are self-renewing populations of cells. They're just functional cells that they're transplanting.
A question on the side here.
I have two questions. For gene therapy, have they what vectors are being used, and have they tried engineering things such as retroviruses to recognize specific stem cell markers for infection?
No, I think I confused you guys. The gene therapy does not create stem cells.
Well, right. But, I mean, if they're missing something that's supposed to be expressed, can we engineer a virus to then give it to them?
That's normally how gene therapy is done. There's a couple of different ways of doing it, but usually they use mouse retroviruses, although they're trying to use lentiviruses now that are human retroviruses based on HIV. There are some other viruses like adeno-associated virus, and even studies now trying to just inject DNA into tissues to try and do gene therapy with naked DNA. But, yeah, often it's done with retroviruses. So you're trying to get the retrovirus to infect with the repaired gene into a stem cell population and then not replicate and make more viruses, but just stay in that cell and produce the gene or express the gene.
And my second question, when you're trying to get compel cells to differentiate down a certain path, is it that we do not know enough of the factors that are involved in that, or do we not know the environment in which they are given to the cell, like the timing or concentration versus other ones?
All of the above.
Okay.
So we do know a little bit. So in the pancreas, and I could give a whole different talk on this, but we actually know a few things about the environment that the cells that are going to become the pancreas, what the environment is. And in that case, often it's a secreted factor that they're exposed to by an adjacent tissue. So it's concentration, it's timing, it's cell-cell contact, and but pretty much anything that could be in the environment of the cell could actually regulate its differentiation. We know a few things about that. I think we'll learn a lot more from this because we can genetically manipulate these cells pretty much at will and be able to look at those alterations and what that does to the downstream differentiation process. But we also just add factors in there at different concentrations at different times and see what happens too.
Mary, this has been a fascinating talk, and I think you've turned us into graduate students based on the kinds of questions I'm hearing here. My goodness, we're using the language and everything. I have a question for you, and that is, what drew you into this field? And tell us a little bit about the pipeline of students coming into this. What's exciting them, and where's it headed?
Well,
with those students.
I actually started being interested in stem cells because I was sitting in a pretty boring embryology class in undergraduate, and seriously, they were just as boring for me as anyone else. So I was sitting there and going, and my professor said something that just about pinned me to the wall. It's something so obvious. We all start out as one cell, and then they divide, and they're identical. Because if you separate them, you get identical twins. And they divide again, and you could have identical quadruplets. They divide again, 8 cells, completely identical. And then something happens where they divide and divide and divide, and suddenly they start to change. And this process of this idea, we didn't even call it self-renewal then. This self-renewal versus differentiation was just amazing to me. How could we be all this complicated and start out as one little cell, like a teeny little cell, too? So how did that happen? And then from then on, I was hooked. Not even knowing about stem cells. I didn't actually even know what a stem... You know, the only stem cell I learned about in my undergraduate biology was in plants. So I didn't even know what I was interested in. But I just kind of followed that along. And in fact, I'm still studying that. What I was interested in, I was 17 when I took that class. I'm still interested in that and still studying that. But the pathway here... And I should say... People always ask me, and have asked me since I came here, why I came to Minnesota. And I'll tell you that, again, nobody in the medical research asks me. No one in San Francisco asks me that either. Only people in Minnesota ask me that question. And I think it's kind of funny. But this is a great place to do science. The first bone marrow transplant, pioneer research in pancreatic transplants, the absolute best place for an islet transplant, and the first stem cell institute in the world. I mean, I could hardly be anywhere else, really. So this is why I'm here, and this is why I'm interested in this. But I actually have another focus in my lab to study this self-renewal question as well. And none of my students want to study that. They all want to cure diabetes. So I actually am not even on the Stem Cell Institute website yet. They haven't caught up on the website yet. And I still have students coming to me and saying, I'm interested in this. And I think a lot of them are interested in it because it's, you know, it's in the media a lot, but a lot of them are interested in it because they say, oh, my grandmother has diabetes, or I have diabetes, or I'm interested in this therapy because my father died from Parkinson's disease or something like that. There's usually something very personal that they're interested in that they want to study this. But there are always these students who come in and they say, oh, yeah, I want to study the stem cells. And this is what I do. Seriously, if you come to my lab, I'll do this to you. I ask two questions before you can work in my lab. What kind of stem cells are you interested in, and why are you interested in stem cells? And if you can answer those two questions, then, and practically never do they, then I think that you've thought about this. So I have students who come to me and they say, I just want to learn about these cells because my public health theories have to do with, you know, equality of distribution of expensive health care. This is a really good reason to study stem cells. And it's a really good reason to study the policy surrounding stem cell research. These are going to be very expensive therapies. And we have to decide what we want to do, how we want to allocate our funds. So there's lots of different reasons to study this. And I'm always amazed that someone comes up with a new one every time. I had someone come to me and say, I'm interested in becoming a clinical embryologist and doing in vitro fertilization, so I want to study this in your lab. Those kinds of people usually know exactly what they want to do. So, but these are undergrads, so I have several undergraduate students in my lab, and the graduate students are usually a little bit more have a pretty more clear understanding of the type of research they want to do. Many of the students who come to my lab are developmental biologists and came to it through the same interest that I did, where we were studying embryology. And now we're starting to get a lot of engineering students coming to the lab because this is a cutting edge of engineering research as well. So there's lots of different paths they come to our door. But they somehow find me.
Can't you imagine how fortunate we are to have her here drawing those kinds of students and inspiring them? We are so glad to have you share this with us tonight, and so glad you're at the University of Minnesota. We'll be interested in following your career and following your contributions to our health and science over your span of career, and I hope it's at Minnesota. Thank you very much. Join me. Well, I want to thank you all for coming again tonight and for your just stunning questions. I swear, I think there's some plants here, grad students or whatever it might be. I do hope you'll join us again next month for another inspiring evening, and this will be with Regents Professor of Ecology David Tillman. He's going to be discussing his breakthrough research on converting prairie grasses into biofuels. Professor Tillman's research is the cover story in the issue of the journal Science, which is actually being released tomorrow. So please note, too, that we've changed the date for the next headliners to the second Thursday of January. That would be January 11th, in order to accommodate Professor Tillman's travel schedule. So you can purchase tickets here tonight for that event if you'd like, or get them in your usual way. And we certainly do hope you'll join us to start the new year with for a change, some optimistic news about the environment. Have a wonderful holiday season, everyone. Thank you again for being here. And thank you, Mary. This was just stunning.
Thank you.